I'm Kathy with a C.
And I'm Kathy with a K.
And this is Killer Destinations.
Is it possible that an infamous murder victim from 1947, the Black Dahlia, and a taunting serial killer from the late 1960s, the Zodiac, are the work of one maniacal individual? One man says it is, and he's ready to name names.
Los Angeles in 1947 was a booming metropolis fueled by a huge post-war population influx and new industries drawn to the vibrant area. Aerospace, with its large defense contracts, flocked to the area and its many high-ranking universities, alongside a massive growth in electronics, chemicals, and oil refineries. It was also the beginning of the car-centric culture, with the decline of streetcars and the development of freeways that connected residents to the rapidly expanding suburbs with their shopping malls and mid-century modern design homes. In downtown LA, City Hall stood as the tallest structure overlooking the city, and the streets were packed with commercial buildings, theaters, and department stores. There were also new restaurants that soon became icons, names that every Angeleno knows, like Musso and Frank, the Brown Derby, Ciro's, and the Pantry, illustrating LA's transformation into a bustling metropolis. It was under the shine of this glittery era that a young Hollywood hopeful was savagely murdered and grotesquely displayed. She became one of LA's most notorious cold cases. But it wasn't until almost 80 years later that a serial killer who had terrorized Northern California in the late 1960s was reportedly connected to the fascinating mystery of who killed this hopeful young starlet.
So today's episode is going to be a little bit different than the ones we usually do because we are actually going to be talking about a current story that delves into the past. As I think many true crime fans learned shortly before Christmas, a man named Alex Baber and his company has come out and said not only did they figure out who the Zodiac Killer was, but they were also able to link it as the same person who killed Elizabeth Short, known as the Black Dahlia. So for those of you who might not know about either case or know a lot about one or the other, we're going to start with just brief summaries, and then we're going to get into what Alex Baber is now saying is behind his claim that the murders have been solved. So we're first going to talk about Elizabeth Short, known as the Black Dahlia. On the morning of January 15th, 1947, so almost 80 years ago, a mother was taking her child for a walk in the Leimert Park neighborhood just south of downtown Los Angeles, and she passed by a vacant lot. Kath, as she passed this vacant lot, and imagine it's dirt with all sorts of weeds and everything growing up around it, she saw what she thought was a mannequin just a few feet off the sidewalk. But as she got closer and closer to what she thought was a mannequin, she realized it was actually the body of a young woman. Now, when police arrived, they found a young woman whose body had been neatly cut completely in half, bisected. And the reason we're saying neatly is because there weren't any jagged bones or skin. Her organs had also been completely removed and were placed on the side of the body. And then also near the body were several empty concrete bags, and police believed that they had likely been used to transport the body to the vacant lot. In addition to being bisected, the body had several areas of mutilation. She had clearly been struck numerous times on her head with a heavy object, and then she had chunks of flesh removed. One was from an upper arm, one was from a leg. And then worst of all, she had what is referred to as a Cheshire smile, which basically means they carved a smile from her lips to her ears. But despite this extensive mutilation and all the cuts on the body, there wasn't a drop of blood at the scene, indicating that the young woman had been killed elsewhere. Now, there were no personal effects left with the body, so the LAPD reached out to the FBI for assistance, and using fingerprints, they were able to identify the victim as 22-year-old Massachusetts native and Hollywood hopeful Elizabeth Short. The autopsy revealed that she had likely been dead for 10 to 12 hours when she was discovered, and the cause of death was determined to be cerebral hemorrhage and shock the hemorrhage being attributed to the heavy blows on her face. And, you know, what's interesting, Kathy, is I think so many people know the term the Black Dahlia and associate it with Elizabeth Short, but this name was actually something that she was dubbed by the press. And it was based on a couple of things. One, her hair had been dyed black. Her normal hair color was just like a chestnut brown. And friends said that she preferred black clothing. Now, in addition, there was a popular crime movie in theaters at the time called The Blue Dahlia. And a dahlia is a flower. And so, bing, bang, bong, they mixed it all together and they came up with the Black Dahlia.
Exactly. And I think there's also a picture of Elizabeth Short with a flower in her hair.
Yes.
I don't believe it's a dahlia, but...
But she did like to wear flowers in her hair.
Exactly. Combined with all of that, you know...
Bing, bang, bong, it's going to stick.
Bing, bang, bong.
Now, a big development occurred just a little over a week later when the killer contacted the press. An envelope addressed to the Los Angeles Examiner and other Los Angeles newspapers was mailed and included a letter assembled from words cut out of the movie ads of a newspaper page and included the phrase, "Heaven is here," from the ad for a movie called Stairway to Heaven. The letter said, "Here is Dahlia's belongings." And these belongings included Elizabeth Short's birth certificate and an address book, business cards, and some photographs. All of them had been cleaned with gasoline, and it turned out that her body had also been cleaned with gasoline to remove any prints. The FBI, which had been running record checks on potential suspects, actually interviewed each one of the 75 men listed in her address book, but nothing went anywhere and nobody was charged. Now, in addition, based on suspicions that the murderer might have had skills in dissection, because as we said, the body was so cleanly cut and had been drained completely of blood, agents were also asked to check out a group of students at the University of Southern California Medical School. And when they did, nobody emerged as a leading suspect. Now, although the Black Dahlia case became one of the country's most famous cold cases, and of course, we're now at 79 years in 2026, it wasn't for a lack of effort by law enforcement. Over 750 investigators from varying agencies were involved in the case, hundreds of interviews were conducted, and a $10,000 reward, which is $145,000 in 2026 dollars, was offered for information about the case. But no major progress was ever made because there was no physical evidence to help identify the perpetrator. And then in addition, in the months and years that followed, more than 60 people came forward and falsely confessed that they had committed the crime. And this, Kath, was actually in addition to the hundreds of people who called and said, "My neighbor, my husband, my boyfriend, my brother, you know, whomever."
Exactly.
They did it.
Mm-hmm. All right, so now we're going to talk about the Zodiac Killer. And as all of you guys know, the Zodiac is a pseudonym for an unidentified serial killer who murdered at least five people in the San Francisco Bay Area between December 1968 and October 1969. Now, he claimed to have murdered 37, but police can only conclusively tie him to five. And investigators agree that he attacked seven people. Three of them were couples, sort of a lover's lane situation, and one was a cab driver. Now, five of the victims died and two survived. So in December of 1968, David Faraday, who was 17 years old, and Betty Lou Jensen, who was 16.
They were babies.
Babies. They were shot and both killed. Fast forward about 8 months, so we're in July of 1969. Michael Mageau and Darlene Farron, Michael was 19, Darlene was 22. They were both shot around midnight in the parking lot of Blue Rock Springs Park. Michael survived the attack, but Darlene died. So 2 months later, Brian Hartnell, age 20, and Cecilia Shepherd, age 22, were stabbed at Lake Berryessa in Napa County. After hanging on for 2 days, Cecilia died, but Brian survived his injuries. And then lastly, 2 weeks after Brian and Cecilia were attacked, a cab driver named Paul Stein, who was 29 years old, was shot and killed in the Presidio Heights neighborhood of San Francisco. So, one of the things that made these crimes so utterly fascinating and completely captivated the public's attention was the fact that the killer called himself the Zodiac and sent 21 letters to Bay Area newspapers beginning in 1969. And he took credit for the murders. And he described details known only to the police. He threatened bombings and more murders if the newspapers did not print his letters. Now, here's what's interesting. These 21 letters were confirmed to be from the same individual. There were other cranks who sent letters and made phone calls and all this kind of nonsense, but police know that 21 are attributed to the killer. In four of these letters, he sent what I would call puzzles. Everyone else is calling them ciphers because they're probably more accurately ciphers. And these ciphers needed to be decoded. So imagine four of the letters just written by hand, making regular statements, and then containing, say, between a, like paragraph 2 and 3, a cipher. And what I mean by a cipher is it had a series of letters and symbols directly next to each other. There was no spacing. It was just this big gobbledygook of symbols and letters that meant something that had to be decoded. So the Zodiac was toying with everyone. And the ciphers were called Z408, Z13. The Z stood for Zodiac. The number next to it stood for the total number of symbols in the cipher, symbols and letters. Of the four ciphers sent by the Zodiac killer, two have been confirmed solved. Z408, which was the first one, Z being Zodiac, 408 symbols in the cipher, was sent in late July 1969 after the first two attacks. Now, this is what's interesting. This cipher was sent in segments, and it was sent to three different newspapers. And each of the newspapers received a different segment, and the Zodiac killer directed them to publish the ciphers. All of them did. And here's the crazy thing. This cipher was solved a week later by amateur code breakers Donald and Betty Hardin from Salinas, California.
I absolutely love that. Just like rock stars.
I know.
Do you know how many people I'm sure were like, oh, challenge, I'm doing it. You know what I mean?
Oh, like, totally. You know, Betty's like, you know, I do love the funnies and I love how they have crossword puzzles and word searches. I bet I can do this. She's probably like, Donald, get over here. We can do this. All right. So Z408 read, I like killing people because it is so much fun. It is more fun than killing wild game in the forest because man is the most dangerous animal of all. To kill something gives me the most thrilling experience. It is even better than getting your rocks off with a girl. The best part of it is that when I die, I will be reborn in paradise and all that I have killed will become my slaves. I will not give you my name because you will try to slow down or stop my collecting of slaves for my afterlife. So the decoded message didn't reveal his identity as initially promised, but rather it contained the boastful message that he liked killing people because it was so much fun. The Zodiac's last letter was received by the San Francisco Chronicle in 1974. In the letter, the Zodiac claimed to have killed 37 people, one of which was a 1966 murder of a woman in Riverside, California, which is in Southern California. And this victim was Sherry Jo Bates.
Now, we know Sherry Jo. So for our Patreon, our subscribers get bonus episodes every month. And the one that we did in November actually was the case of Sherry Jo Bates. It was believed that she was the Zodiac killer's very first victim. But you can get a free 7-day trial of Patreon at the $10 level. If you're interested in this case and in Zodiac, it's a fascinating episode.
Yeah.
We learned so much. So you can go to patreon.com, type in killer destinations when it comes up, sign up for the free 7-day trial and take a listen.
Exactly. You guys got to do it. It's a good episode. You know, Kath, one little side note. These letters by the Zodiac were sent between 1969 and 1974. And in the first sentence of the third letter, the writer identified himself, this is the Zodiac speaking. So that's obviously how he became the Zodiac killer. And he signed his letters with a symbol. And it's basically a symbol that resembles the crosshairs of a gun sight. It's like, remember when you're little and like Wile E. Coyote cartoon was in the crosshairs?
Right. Exactly. That's a great example.
Exactly.
I like it.
One of the journalists who spent a lot of time on this case was a guy named Paul Avery, and he worked for the San Francisco Chronicle. And when the letters were sent to the San Francisco Chronicle, they were addressed to him. Okay. So in one of the letters, the Zodiac requested to speak with attorney Melvin Belli, who was a very famous attorney, live on air. And I cannot remember the name of the show that actually hosted him.
It was like the Don Shepherd Show.
It was something like that. Anyway, you guys can look this up on YouTube. And so somebody calls in and was like, This is the Zodiac speaking. You can tell Melvin Belli and the host were trying to keep the caller on the line, but he only said a couple things before he hung up.
Right. And one of the things that I guess he had intimated in the letter is that he kind of wanted legal advice from Belli because he didn't want to go to the gas chamber.
Right.
And it's the Jim Dunbar show. Thankfully, you spoke long enough that I was able to look it up. And by speaking long enough, it was like 12 seconds.
Anyway, despite several theories about the Zodiac's true identity, the only suspect police ever named was a man named Arthur Lee Allen, who was a former elementary school teacher and a convicted sex offender who died in 1992. He was eliminated-ish because of physical evidence. For example, his palm print and his fingerprints didn't match those found at the crime scene. And police had a partial DNA profile from saliva. Actually, it was saliva on a stamp on one of the envelopes. And it was this teensy, teensy, weensy amount, but this guy's DNA didn't match. And Kathy, a lot of people have questioned the reliability of using that DNA sample because it was so tiny. And they couldn't make a full genetic profile anyway.
But not only that, he didn't necessarily lick the stamp himself.
Oh, the killer, you're saying.
Exactly.
That's true.
He might have had his dog do it.
Yeah. He turns to his wife, honey, open your mouth.
Exactly.
If you are a killer and you can create those crazy ciphers, then you're not a dum-dum.
So after the first encrypted cipher that, as we said, was solved by Donald and Betty in a week, the Zodiac ciphers became more complicated. Now, the first one we said was Z408, so Zodiac with 408 characters. The second one was Z340, and Kath, it was not decoded until December 2020, 51 years after it was sent to the newspapers in November 1969. In this case, it was a team of code breakers who decided to try and crack the code specifically because they knew it would be a challenge. The three men were David Oranchak, Sam Blake, and what I believe is Jarl van Eyck. They used software to help them break the cipher, and ultimately what they found the message to reveal was, I hope you are having lots of fun in trying to catch me. That wasn't me on the TV show, which brings up a point about me. I am not afraid of the gas chamber because it will send me to paradise all the sooner because I now have enough slaves to work for me where everyone else has nothing when they reach paradise, so they are afraid of death. I am not afraid because I know that my new life is life will be an easy one in paradise, death. What was interesting is that the interviewer said that at the time that the line of that wasn't me on the TV show, they knew referred to this Jim Dunbar show with Melvin Belli. And I guess when the caller was on the line, Kathy, when he called into this TV show, he said, I need help. I'm sick. I don't want to go to the gas chamber. So for the code breakers, this little detail made the decoded cipher seem authentic as it fit with events that happened around the time it was received.
Right.
And then, of course, the rest of the message also seemed quite in character for the Zodiac killer. You know, I'm great. I did it. Can't catch me. I'm the gingerbread man. All those kinds of things. I'm paraphrasing.
I like that. The gingerbread man.
Now, this team of three code breakers submitted their solution to the FBI. And a year later, so on December 28th, 2021, the FBI confirmed they had correctly broken the cipher.
So now here we are, and two of the ciphers remained unsolved. Or is it just one? The two shorter ciphers, Z13, which was sent in April 1970, and Z32, sent in June of 1970, remained unsolved. But on December 22nd, 2025, just a few weeks ago, in a world-exclusive interview in the Daily Mail, journalists Rachel Sharp and Josh Boswell broke the story that Alex Baber, the co-founder of a company called Cold Case Consultants of America, claimed he had finally cracked the Z13 cipher using AI, newly released census records, and classic cryptography. And, according to Baber, the cipher included the Zodiac Killer's true name. But that wasn't all. Alex Baber said he also concluded that the Zodiac Killer and the person who murdered the Black Dahlia, Elizabeth Short, were the same man. And according to Baber, the man's name is Marvin Merrill. His real name turned out to be Marvin Margolis, because as we get into it, we'll tell you why he changed his name.
According to the podcast Killer in the Code, and this is about Alex Baber's discovery, the podcast is actually hosted by famous author and Kathy's favorite, Michael Connelly. So call us, please. I'll give you Kathy's number.
Exactly. Michael Connelly is my freaking favorite author. I love him. I love him. Love you, Michael.
Kisses. I'm totally putting that in. And nothing you can say will make that come out.
Michael Connelly's going to hear us and be like, ew. I know.
He's like, another woman like another? That? But anyways, according to this podcast, Alex Baber said that he originally set out to try and solve the Zodiac murders and unmask the killer. And the first step was solving the two unsolved ciphers, Z13 and Z32. And understandably, they knew that these were harder to solve because one of the things people looked for when they were trying to solve the ciphers was a pattern of letters throughout that would help them know, oh, are these duplicate letters? Oh, is that the word the? You know, things that would just kind of fall into place. And the fewer characters, the fewer patterns. So Z13, though, was particularly captivating to Baber because the cipher was sent with a note that said, "This is the Zodiac speaking. By the way, have you cracked the last cipher I sent you?" And remember, this last cipher had been sent in November 1969, and it took 51 years to solve. But anyways, it said, "By the way, have you cracked the last cipher I sent you? My name is ... And after those words were 13 letters and symbols. So, of course, Alex Baber believes this is the man's name. So 4 years ago, this was just after Z340 was solved, Alex Baber began his quest to solve Z13 and unmask the Zodiac Killer once and for all. He thought with AI advancements moving forward by leaps and bounds, that could be the solution. So, Kath, what he did is, knowing that the Z13 cipher that he had was assumed to be the actual name of the killer, he designed a computer program to compile a list of first and last names in the United States that totaled 13 letters.
That would include you.
It would include me. It also includes my sister. Oh. Kath, the original list contained 71 million names. And then the original Z13 cipher also showed that it contained three symbols that were repeated twice. So essentially, there were three sets of double letters in these two names.
Dude, that also includes you.
It absolutely does.
Although you're not old enough to be the killer, but anyway.
I'm not, but still.
But you have those instincts.
I definitely do. Thank you to all of our listeners. But there was a fourth symbol that was repeated three times.
I'm trying to think if you have that.
I do not.
You do not. You do not. You
no.
do not.
Wah, wah. Wah, wah. I'm eliminated.
You're not the killer.
But of course, this narrowed the potential suspects even further. And then Alex Baber added additional qualifiers. So of course, he has these 71 million names that included me and my sister. And so Baber now needs to narrow the suspects further. And so, as we said, two men survived the attack by the Zodiac Killer. And because of that, they were able to provide details and come up with a composite sketch. So Alex Baber knew the Zodiac was a white male who police believed was in his mid-30s to mid-40s when the murders took place. So he went through and did that. We're still looking at a few million people. And then he went through census records and military records and on, and he was able to narrow the number from 71 million to 14. Alex Baber then went through the final 14 possibilities, and Kathy was actually able to eliminate 13 of them by utilizing additional qualifying factors such as height, background, and proximity to Northern California, where the murders occurred. And that left just one name, Marvin Merrill.
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance in the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown in the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
So Alex's company, Cold Case Consultants of America, started doing an even deeper dive into Marvin Merrill. And they were able to place Merrill in Northern California at the time of the Zodiac killings, but then found records that he'd been in Oceanside, California in 1971 and was charged with 5 counts of fraud and spent 3 years on probation. And Kat, this jived with the period of time when the Zodiac had gone silent.
But what's weird about that too, though, Kath, is that he was on probation. He wasn't locked up.
Yeah, I don't know how wrapped up he was in the fraud system.
Right.
And when you're on probation, oftentimes you can't go outside a certain county.
As long as you're not caught. I just mean that, like, there wasn't anything physically barring him from leaving that county, like a jail cell.
Right. I mean, if his convictions did not include jail time, then you are correct.
And it looks like it didn't. It looks like he just got probation for
okay. it. Okay. But, you know.
But it's just something to point out. That
right,
was all.
Exactly. But, Kath, one thing that stood out to Alex Baber was that he couldn't find any military records, property records, voting records, census records with the last name Merrill on them before the 1960s. But he was able to get a hold of records from the Social Security Administration, and I honestly don't know how.
I was actually surprised at that, too.
Yeah.
Because those are hard to get.
Right. And they told Baber that Merrill had a history of using 2 different Social Security numbers, neither of which belonged to him. One apparently belonged to a woman in Chicago, and the other belonged to a man named Marvin Margolis, who also lived in Chicago. And the Social Security record showed that Marvin Merrill was apparently an alias for Marvin Margolis.
And Kathy, in the Daily Mail article that I had referenced earlier, Alex Baber had said, you know, you have Marvin Merrill and Marvin Margolis, and you're looking at, like, are these the same men? Is it just a coincidence that they have the same Social Security number? And so what Alex Baber did is he looked at the birthplace and birth date of both men, and they both had the exact same place of birth and date of birth.
So he knew that they were one and the same person.
Exactly.
Okay, so Baber now is like, okay, why did he use this fictitious name? What's going on? And so he dug deeper because he assumed that Marvin Merrill was doing something illegal when he was Marvin Margolis, and that's why he changed his name. So he kept digging, and through military records related to Marvin Margolis, it showed that he had served as a hospital corpsman attached to a Marine battalion during World War II. After being discharged, he returned to Chicago, but turned up in California in 1946. So he was living in Hollywood and taking pre-med classes at the University of Southern California. So now Baber knows, like, okay, Margolis and Merrill are the same people. Then Baber had a mind-blowing moment. So he's digging deep into who Marvin Margolis was, and he's pulling up any records he can. And he discovered that Marvin Margolis' name was listed in a 1951 grand jury report. I have no idea how he got this, but the grand jury had been convened 2 years prior, so in 1949, for the purpose of looking into the unsolved murder of Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia. And the report that Baber found said Margolis had been one of the prime suspects in her murder. Now, Kat, as you know, we just said he attended USC Medical School. And remember, when she died, they actually went and interviewed med students, assuming that her killer was familiar with surgical techniques.
Right. And honestly, it's a lot easier to go to a med school than to look at every single doctor in Los Angeles.
Right. And so not only was Marvin Margolis a pre-med student, it turns out he actually lived with Elizabeth Short as her boyfriend for a very short period of time, just months before her murder. So for 2 years, the grand jury heard testimony from witnesses, including the lead investigators in the case, who provided the jury with a list of 21 possible suspects in Elizabeth's murder. And according to this grand jury report, what brought Margolis to the attention of detectives was that they found out that they had lived together just 3 months before, and he initially did not admit that when detectives came to USC.
Another important point, though, we said that he lived for a very short time. We're not talking months.
Right.
We're talking 12 days.
12 days. Yeah.
And he lived with Elizabeth Short and another couple.
And I think, did the three of them live together and then he joined them, or how did that go?
Marvin Margolis was friends with the couple, and Elizabeth Short was brought in because they had started dating. And everything that I read about Elizabeth Short is that she was very transient because, like, she would go from boarding house to motel to boarding house. You know, there were so many people in Hollywood, especially young women, who were just looking for that break.
Right.
Were working odd jobs or, you know, part-time jobs to be able to get it. And so my understanding is that LA at the time very much catered to a transient population.
Right, right. So according to a December 23rd, 2025 article in the Los Angeles Times by Christopher Gofford, once detectives found out that Elizabeth and Marvin Margolis lived together for a brief period of time, they gave him a really, really hard look. Now, they knew he was in medical school, but they also found out that he was a World War II veteran who served in the medical corps and who had expressed an eagerness to practice surgery. However, despite the grand jury being given evidence about Marvin Margolis and despite detectives' best efforts to uncover any connection between him and Elizabeth's murder, he was never arrested. And he was never arrested because there was no direct evidence that they uncovered. So he returned to his hometown, Chicago. And unbeknownst to police, he subsequently changed his name to Marvin Merrill, and as far as we know, had no further contact with police.
So that's where we are so far with Alex Baber's efforts to connect the two. You know, honestly, I'm not convinced yet. And I'm not saying that I think he's wrong. I'm just saying that if you have a murder 80 years later,
you just think the coffin has not been nailed shut.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's difficult in these situations.
Totally.
Where it's not like there's a bounding DNA.
Right. And even if it had been kept, is it degraded by now?
Yeah. I mean,
right.
Who knows?
And all of the players are dead.
Right.
So anyways, there is still a lot of vetting to do, which is something that Alex Baber has said, and there's other things that they're doing. But there are two people who are questioning Alex's claims that Marvin Merrill is the killer. Now, the first person who's questioning this is Marvin Merrill's youngest son. But this man, when he spoke to the Daily Mail, asked to remain anonymous. And he's in this article that we had talked about. Now, apparently, his youngest son handed over boxes upon boxes to Alex Baber containing more than 200 items that once belonged to his father. But the son says he still remains skeptical that he's in fact the son of a serial killer. And part of that, actually, Kathy, is also because when Alex Baber was talking about Marvin Margolis changing his name to Marvin Merrill, it was he had to have been doing something nefarious or something that would have gotten him in trouble. That's the only reason to change a name. Well, the son says actually there's another reason for it. Merrill's son said that his father had always let them know that he had changed his name when he was younger. And he said he did so because he had gone to Atlanta after living in Chicago for a time, and he was a car salesman, but he faced significant anti-Semitism in the area because nobody wanted to do business with somebody with a Jewish last name. And so as a result, he changed his name to a much plainer name, so it didn't have any sort of ethnic or religious connotation. But some of the things that were in the boxes that the son shared with Baber, one of them was a bayonet, and near the hilt, this is the part by the handle, there were two engraved symbols. One of the symbols was an upside down 8, so the larger part of the 8 is now on the top, and the number is surrounded by a circle. This was one of the symbols found in one of the Zodiac's ciphers. The other symbol that was on the bayonet hilt was not seen in any of the ciphers. Alex Baber said the bayonet was something that Merrill brought back with him after the war, but the son said his dad told him he had brought it back from Korea. So we don't know its origin story.
Right. And if it was obviously Korea, then it's well past Elizabeth's time of death.
Correct.
And Kath, the reason this bayonet is important, as you know, is because the second two victims of the Zodiac were killed by a bayonet-type weapon.
Now, among what Alex Baber claimed was one of the most damning pieces of evidence against Merrill is something that he found in this box as well, and it was one of the final sketches that Merrill drew. Apparently, he had been diagnosed with terminal cancer, and about a year before his death, he drew an image in black ink depicting a nude woman's body from the waist up that was set against a darkly shaded background. And beneath the figure appears the name Elizabeth, written in capital letters, that Baber believes looks similar to the handwriting in the Zodiac's letters.
I think it's interesting, and I think everybody should look up this image.
Yes, because it does not look like the Black Dahlia. When the Daily Mail asked the Sun about the sketch, the Sun said that his father had a girlfriend named Elizabeth around the time it was drawn, and so that very well could have been her. The sketch was signed Marty Merrill 92, and Martin Merrill died just the year following in 93 in Santa Barbara, California.
And Alex Baber actually referred to this as Merrill's deathbed confession. And he did so because he used image-enhancing software, and he looked at the drawing for hidden clues, okay? So imagine you have a pen and ink sketch of a woman, and the background is completely blackened out, like just completely sketched over. What Baber did was, with this software, was try to, I'm going to call it, peel back the layers of the ink. And the software reveals what appears to be the word Zodiac beneath the ink. Now, it would be a capital Z, a small O, a capital D, an IAC. So I don't believe the Zodiac signed his name like that with like the capital D, but I don't know. And so I've also seen images of this, and everybody should look this up.
But don't look up images on Google, because people have filled in the letters with black ink.
People have filled in the letters, and there's a lot of people on Reddit that have filled in the letters.
Yes.
But if you try to get the purest version of what Alex Baber did, you can see that there are some letters. I honestly couldn't make it out to be Zodiac. However, when I saw how people sort of like penciled over, I was like, okay.
But they weren't penciling exactly over. That's the problem, right? Like, they're making you see what they see or what they want to see.
Right.
And that's why, like, Daily Mail has the pictures. You can look at it. You can kind of like see a Z. You can kind of see it like a
you
C at
see
the
an
end.
O,
yeah.
But it's like, it's interesting.
It is interesting.
It's interesting.
I agree.
But it's like nothing is crystal clear. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
There's so much that's left to our, you know, because when I first looked at it, I'm like, nah, that doesn't say Zodiac. But when I saw how people shaded over it, and then I looked at it again, I'm like, okay, I could see how it's, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, exactly.
The power of suggestion, or is it true observation?
You don't know.
You know what I mean?
Right, exactly. That's why I said don't look at the other images, because you don't want that power of suggestion. Look at it.
Just look at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See if you can get that.
Exactly.
Merrill's son gave this drawing over to Baber's team, as we said, and his team, according to the article, said that they have shared it with a forensic image analyst for independent review, and they said numerous handwriting examples have been collected, and they have been sent also to an independent expert for comparison to both the Zodiac and Black Dahlia killer's letters. So all of that is still to come to verify what they're saying they found. And Kath, here's something else that was interesting too, is that Alex Baber told the Daily Mail that Merrill's youngest son admitted that he now believed that his father was the Zodiac killer and the murderer of Elizabeth Short, based on the evidence presented to him. But when the son was contacted by the Daily Mail, the son denied this and called the theory and findings, quote, a speculative cesspool and fiction, and said, I don't believe that dad did it. The son insisted that the Black Dahlia murder was 20 years before he was born, and he would love the families to have peace, you know, in the Zodiac killings. But he said there was just no way it was his dad. And there's just no way my dad killed kids.
Meaning young people, not actual kids.
Right.
So the other challenge to the theory is Steve Hodell. And I think we've talked about him before on the podcast.
Because we wanted to do the Black Dahlia case with him on the podcast.
Oh, was that our,
that was our
grand lofty goal?
It was, because I will say, I didn't follow a lot of Zodiac. It's not something that's ever really held a lot of interest for me, mm-hmm. until we did the Sherry Joe Bates episode.
Right.
Join Patreon for free for 7 days at the $10 level, and you can listen to it as well. It is a good story. But anyway, I was always fascinated with this. And I know part of it was because...
With the Dahlia.
Yeah, with Black Dahlia. Yeah. And I know part of it's because my dad was LAPD, as I've said. And so all of those like inner workings and machinations, I wish, not that my dad was alive then and...
Right.
Whatever. But it just like, it would have been nice to get insight.
Yes. Yes. So. Yes, definitely. And also it was so detective noir, you know, it was, you know...
It was LA Confidential.
Totally. So anyway, so Steve Hodell is a retired 23-year LAPD homicide detective who went on to become a private investigator. And he actually wrote a book. What was it? Was it
Black Dahlia Avenger? And he's actually written several books on this.
Okay.
But Black Dahlia Avenger is his best known, and it's the one that's being kept up to date.
Right. And I listened to a podcast that he did. Anyway, the bottom line is, in this book, Steve Hodell says that he believes his father was Elizabeth Short's killer. So what happened is, before 1999, Steve Hodell did not have any interest in the Black Dahlia case. He retired from the LAPD 13 years prior and was living in Washington State. But in 1999, his father, whose name is George Hodell, passed away. And when he was going through his father's effects, he found several pictures of a woman that to him looked like the Black Dahlia. And he was like, this is really strange. And so when he was asking family members, like, why did dad have this? Who is this woman? You know, doesn't it look like Elizabeth Short? Around the same time, Steve's niece, who was George Hodell's granddaughter, told Steve that an LA County Sheriff's deputy had told her that her grandfather, George, has been a top suspect in the murder. So his mind was blown. He was like, what the hell? How do I not know about this? So of course, as a former homicide detective, he begins looking into the case to see if it was possible that she was correct. So Steve's father, George Hodell, had been a physician in Los Angeles at the time that Elizabeth Short was murdered. And he was a prominent physician. He served as the head of the Los Angeles County Health Department's Social Hygiene Division.
That's hysterical.
I know. Not a job that I would want.
Do they still have that?
I haven't the vaguest idea.
Hope not.
I doubt it. But anyway, his role, he had specialization in venereal disease control and public health awareness.
All those men coming back for more.
Exactly. And so while he wasn't a surgeon, he had studied anatomy and surgery while in medical school, obviously. And, you know, we said that the crime scene photos showed that Elizabeth Short had been cut in half with precision. And it was actually a procedure called hemicorporectomy. And this is where the body is literally sliced in half at a particular spot on the lumbar spine. And it's the only spot where the body can be severed without breaking bone. And so this was taught in the 1930s when George had been in medical school.
And you know what's weird, Kath? I was looking this up because I don't know how you survive that way. And there have been three that have been done in like the last 20 years alone.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah.
And so I'm assuming it's a situation where, you know, somebody has an extreme situation with their legs and it's gangrenous or something. I don't know.
Right.
But who knows? Anyway, in the situations that you looked up, did they give examples of why they were done?
Yeah, but I don't remember them. I think I'm even though it's been a short time, I think I repressed that.
Exactly. You were only reading it with one eye open.
Exactly.
Also, we talked previously, a little over a week after, you know, Elizabeth was murdered, letters began coming into the police. We only talked about one, but there were actually a few that came in. Now, Steve Hodell believes that these letters bore resemblance to his father's handwriting, so much so that he took notes his father had written and, you know, samples of his handwriting and asked a handwriting expert for her opinion as to the similarity in the penmanship. And he didn't tell this expert who these samples belonged to, but the expert supposedly said that it was her opinion there was a strong likelihood they were written by the same person. However, stopped short of saying it was in fact the same person.
Well, and I actually respect that more because I think handwriting experts, that's a hard thing to do.
Handwriting experts can actually like measure levels of ink on a paper with age, and there's different things you can do, but it's highly, highly technical and very, very rare.
It's bite mark.
Yeah, seriously, it's like bite mark evidence. Anyway, all right.
Thank God for DNA.
Thank God for DNA, for sure. In addition to all this stuff, Steve Hodell went through state records and did like Freedom of Information Act requests for FBI files and things like that. And what he got were files from law enforcement that showed his father topped the LAPD's list of suspects at the time of the crime. And so one of the things that Steve did is he found a folder containing receipts for contracting work on his childhood home. And one of the receipts showed a purchase a few days before Elizabeth's murder of 10 5-pound bags of concrete. And these bags were the same size and brand found near Elizabeth's body. And as we said previously, police believed that her killer used this to carry her to the place where she was dumped.
In 2001, this is now 2 years after researching his father's potential involvement, Steve Hodell turned to a man named Stephen Kay. This was an acquaintance who he knew through the district attorney's office, and at the time, Stephen Kay was the head deputy district attorney. Now, Steve Hodell still wasn't sure he could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that his father was the Black Dahlia killer, but he was convinced his investigation had unearthed enough new material to justify a fresh look from law enforcement officials. So, Deputy District Attorney Kay agreed to review Steve's work, and 6 weeks later, Deputy District Attorney Kay responded with a letter that said, "Thanks to some great detective work by his courageous son Steve, the name of Dr. George Hodell will live in infamy." Kay added that if George were still alive, he would file murder charges against him. So it was at this point that Steve Hodell wrote his first book, which became a best-selling book about the case. And there was a journalist at the Los Angeles Times at the time. His name was Steve Lopez. Lots of Steves flying around this place. And while fact-checking his column, Steve Lopez went to the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office to get more information on the murder. And they actually complied, which I'm not sure why that surprised me, but it did. But
he's a pretty known, well-known columnist. Maybe that's why.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Okay. And so the DA's office actually gave him information that they had found in a basement safe in the district attorney's office.
That is so crazy.
Isn't it? It was a stack of files and it had everything from financial records to records from George Hodell's private practice. As we said, he worked for the county, but he also had a private practice as a VD doctor.
Right.
And so Lopez was going through all of this and he came across some really interesting things. In February of 1950, so this is just 3 years after the Black Dahlia, Elizabeth Short, was murdered, there was a recording of a conversation between George and another person. Now, they only got George's side of the conversation because it was a phone call, and it was not the phone that was being bugged. It was the downstairs room that George Hodell used as a workspace. He had a secretary named Ruth Spalding, and she had died a couple of years before Black Dahlia. It was 1945. And it looked like there had been an investigation into George Hodell for cooking the books.
Right.
And Ruth had been a secretary for a really long time. It was one of those things where she knew everything.
Right.
And you didn't want to get her to turn on you. And so she was a middle-aged woman.
She was probably 37.
Probably. But she actually died of a barbiturate overdose, even though she was not known to use drugs or alcohol. And so there was suspicion on Hodell because they were in the middle of this investigation.
You're right. They were in the middle of this fraud investigation.
Right.
So what he was alleged to have been doing was that when patients came in, he would write down on paper that this lady had gonorrhea and he would bill for laboratory tests that he actually never administered. And so there was a letter from this one woman who was so horrified that she was accused of having gonorrhea.
And she had been on vacation, right?
Yes. Like she's like, there's no way I could have gonorrhea. There's no way. Like, I didn't do these tests. Basically, it's all fraud. But I don't want to come forward because then I'm going to be known as a lady with gonorrhea.
Exactly.
So the letter, her letter said, upon my death, you can release this information.
And as far as we know, she wasn't killed. But
yeah, exactly.
But Ruth was aware of it. Ruth confirmed for her that no tests had been run.
Right.
But said, I'm required to send you this per my boss.
Exactly.
Like, the doctor said I have to send these bills out.
Exactly.
So Ruth dies. That's 1945. There was always suspicion on George Hodell. It didn't go anywhere, though. Because he was a high-ranking county official, mm-hmm. and that's what mattered back then.
Right.
So some of these transcripts came from a bug that was in this office, and one of them was in February of 1950, so this is 3 years after Elizabeth Short had been killed, and it basically just notes that it says, woman screamed again, and then in parentheses, it should be noted, the woman not heard before the scream. Okay. I'm really glad I wasn't that woman because I would have liked them to have run in and helped me if
exactly,
they heard me screaming.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, listen, a lady screaming in his basement.
Yeah.
Huh. The end. You want to go to lunch? You want to go to lunch?
But later in the day, they have it recorded that George Hodell talked to apparently a confidant and said, realize there was nothing I could do. Put a pillow over her head and cover her with a blanket. Get a taxi, expired 12:59 p.m., and I'm guessing that's when she died. They thought there was something fishy. Anyway, now they may have figured it out. Killed her. Maybe I did kill my secretary. So the surveillance continued. I don't know when this next comment was, but George Hodel said, "Supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia. They couldn't prove it now. They can't talk to my secretary anymore. She's dead."
And the reason that's important is because, you know, these bugs were happening as a result of the Black Dahlia investigation.
Correct.
Not his fraud investigation. But they suspected that he had met Elizabeth Short as a patient at his practice. And the person who could have verified that was his secretary, Ruth Spalding. But she had died 2 years prior. And so now they're wondering, like, did he kill her to hide, you know, all the stuff,
you don't
not
know
just
why.
The fraud, but,
yeah.
you know, the Elizabeth
she
knew Smart
too
stuff.
Much.
Exactly. We don't know. We don't know.
So Alex Baber said his team had shared Marvin Merrill's drawing of Elizabeth to a forensic image analyst for review and numerous handwriting samples for both the Zodiac and Black Dahlia letters also have been sent for review. So we now await that.
We also have no information of any kind on a comparison with DNA directly from Marvin Merrill or any of his family members to compare with a partial DNA profile from the postage stamp on a letter sent from the Zodiac Killer. Kathy, I also don't know if that is still a good specimen.
Right. If it was actually the Zodiac Killer.
Right. But I mean, even if the specimen...
Is it not degraded yet?
Correct. I don't know. I haven't seen anything on that.
So a lot is to be continued.
Exactly.
But we just wanted to start the conversation.
Yeah. And we'll keep you updated. As he reveals more information, we will share it with you.
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offering, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.